The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
On 92.7 and 106 FM.
The Money Show brought to you by APSA Commercial Property Finance. That's Africanacity. APSA is a registered FSP. Good evening. Welcome to The Money Show. What a busy 24 hours it has been, particularly in the story that affects the globe. We'll pick up on that one in a moment. About vaccine producers, the White House saying it supports a global initiative partly started by South Africa to remove the patents on life-saving vaccines and to open up those patents to allow the speedier distribution of vaccines around the world. Really good news from a health perspective. But are we at risk here of missing a bigger picture? So we'll talk about that this evening. Eskom reports today on Bloomberg saying Eskom doesn't want the power ships, the power ship contracts, or anything to do with the power ships. We'll pick up on that this evening. We'll also catch up with a man called Rich Mulholland, who posted the world's best video I have ever seen on the elevator pitch. We've done elevator pitches with Pavlo many times in the past. We've invited you to come in and share your elevator pitches and to practice. And then we laughed at some of you, judged most of you. And some of you did really well on those elevator pitches. You really did. But Rich Mulholland's got a particular perspective on them. We'll share that with you this evening. We'll also talk to Warren Ingram, personal finance, and Pavlo Fotidis, of course, on small business. Tonight, what is it that is holding your small business back?
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
Well, the decision by the U.S. to support efforts to lift patent protection for coronavirus vaccines is good news, and it may help the development of jabs around the world. India and South Africa proposed the plan, which they said would increase vaccine production across the globe. Salome Meyer is a project manager for Access to Medicine campaign at the Cancer Alliance. I mean, you must be hugely welcoming, I've no doubt here, Salome, of the news that the White House has made statement late last night that it would support the lifting of patent protection on vaccines.
Indeed, Bruce, it was wonderful to wake up to that news that at last we have got some light at the end of the tunnel, that the US is supporting the waiver. We hope that that will set the tone then for other countries to follow suit.
How long have you been fighting for medicines access? Because it seems like this has been a battle ever since medicines were in existence and patent protections were allowed on what the manufacturers of these medicines call ethical drugs.
That is a fight that has been going on for as long as patents are protected, and the normal range of patent protection is normally 12 years. And I need to say that we, in the access to medicine field, we understand that patents are in fact very valuable and are required, especially when companies are talking about research and development. However, the issue that we have is the transparency around that, and that particularly goes with what are your research and development costs? Is it really what you claim it is to be? And if we actually just ask the question to Pfizer, that have literally in the last 3 months made $3.5 billion just on the vaccine, one can then ask the question, is that really fair if one has to talk about affordability of medicine?
It's this great dichotomy, isn't it, between the wonderful science, and these companies are at the leading edge of science, and the purpose then of these patents is to allow the drugs manufacturers to recoup often large amounts, and we don't know how much, of development and research costs. They also need to make a profit because they do have shareholders and they do need to grow into the future. The concern I think you have is this element of profiteering by the drugs makers. And you would like greater clarity on what every drug ever patented, ever made?
Exactly. That is what we are asking for. The recent World Health Organization Fair Price Forum also focused on that aspect. And when in 2019 there was the transparency resolution that was accepted, and that was a proposal put forward by Italy, that at least we need to start with the discussion about what is transparency, what is the components of transparency. But apart from that, we need to actually get to the actual definition of what is a fair price. Because what is fair for you that may be in a high-income country may not necessarily be fair for us that is living in a low or middle-income country. And that is very much a discussion that needs to be held. And we hope that hopefully by the time the next fair pricing forum happens, which would be in another 2 years' time, that we can move closer to that definition.
Now, I have no idea, Salome, and I'm hoping that you do, what percentage of drugs that are researched and developed by the big drugs makers actually make it to patent stage and actually then become these global leaders, these super drugs. I mean, we've seen massive anti-depression drugs and some really big breakthrough drugs that have been so successful, and they often held up as sort of saying, you see, this is big pharma gouging profits. But do we have any idea? Is there any disclosure on this as to, you know, is it 1 in 100 drugs that make it to that stage, 1 in 1,000? I have no idea.
To be honest with you, I don't have an idea either. I do know that within the cancer field, you know, that there is not that many that actually make it to the final stage of actually here we have something that has the potential of saving lives and actually adding that additional survival, overall survival rate. What I do think is also important in this whole debate is that we need to actually understand that the majority of medicines in their first and second phase is actually developed with public money. That means it's your and my money that's assisting to actually develop that medicine. Pharma only gets involved once they actually see, wait a bit, here is something in which we can actually make profit from. And that is very much part of our activism around the world, where we say transparency. What part of this drug was actually developed with public money? And what was your input?
And again, there's no clarity on that particular point. And I guess that is a big sticking point. I worry, as somebody who looks at a lot of businesses and understands the profit incentive as the way of encouraging innovation. And I don't think the world has ever seen such a rapid rollout of a successful vaccine in such a short period of time by multiple providers. And all of them would have been looking at the profit incentive, saying if we get to market first and we've got the best that doesn't need to be frozen at minus 78 degrees or whatever the restrictions are, it can be distributed quickly and easily in a single dose. That is the incentive. The incentive is there to get the best possible drug as quickly as possible. And that incentive has worked because the world now has various options open to it. If we now say to these drugs makers, terribly sorry, but we're going to lift your patent on this, the next time we have a global pandemic and we need them to compete, are they going to be as inclined to do so if they fear that they could lose their patent protection?
That is a million-dollar question.
Well, it's about a trillion-dollar question, actually, but because the numbers are big.
We don't have the answer to that. I do think that what we actually should put to the on the table is the whole issue of morality and the moral obligation that when we have a pandemic, as with COVID, there is a moral obligation of countries and of industry to come to the table to save the lives and not to put profit ahead of saving lives of people. That is what we should call for.
How big a process is there still? I mean, yes, the US has thrown its weight behind this, but 100 of the World Trade Organization's 164 states are, I think, in favor of lifting temporarily patent protection on coronavirus vaccines. That's good. I wonder whether or not the World Trade Organization has got the capacity to move really quickly on this. How long do you anticipate we'll have to wait to get absolute clarity?
It is going to take another couple of months, because what is now on the table is word-based negotiations. That means they're going back to the text, and that text needs to be negotiated, and that can take, unfortunately, weeks for that to be finalized, because it's really like horse trading now. What are we going to give up? What are we willing to give up? And what are the demands on the table? So that can take some time. But I am quite confident that with the horses that are in the stable at the moment behind the waiver will actually pull it through for us.
I mean, far more people die every year of diseases like tuberculosis and malaria and cancers, the multitude of cancers that exist. I wonder whether or not the big drugs manufacturers are looking at this and saying, hold on a second, if we open this door and we allow Salome to get her foot in the door on vaccines for coronavirus, because the whole world is obsessed with coronavirus right now, they'll come after all of the other patents next. I mean, that's a real risk for them, and which is why, I guess, they push back so hard in protecting their rights at times like this.
Is absolutely 100% correct, because that, in essence, is what will happen. And I think we'll actually need to also just read again what the U.S. actually have said. They have said, the administration believes strongly in intellectual property protections.
Mm-hmm.
So they are saying, we will do this for COVID. For COVID, yes, we will come to the table. But they already actually are giving a warning that they're not necessarily okay. are going to give up the fight. Because one need to actually ask the question, where are these original companies based? They are based in the US, in the UK, and in the EU. Who are their shareholders? Their shareholders are people within their own country. So that they are protecting their own people as well.
So let me fascinate the discussion. It's a thorny issue, and I wish it could move a lot more quickly. I'd love to get more vaccines in more arms around the world more speedily than has happened to date. But yeah, big breakthrough. It is a massive breakthrough from a health perspective. And that is why the wording, I think, of the White House statement that Salome Meir refers to from the Cancer Alliance is so careful, because the White House does not want to remove the profit incentive completely.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
We'll get to Graham Kerner with the markets in just a moment and chat to him about today on the JSE. It was a really solid day, second solid day in a row. The market had a positive close. We saw financials doing well once again. Most of the industrials doing well. Disappointment amongst paper shares and some of the platinum stocks. Pick up with that with Graham Kerner in a moment.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Graham Kerner with the Kerner Perspective this evening on The Money Show. And Graham Kerner, another positive day on the JSE. I could get used to this. I know it's temporary and fleeting and probably won't last very long. But yeah, a nice 0.33% gain on the JSE, 67,600 or thereabouts.
Yeah, Bruce, good evening. Good evening. I think what was especially gratifying for us today is the Rand was almost 1% better against most of the major currencies. Europe was, kind of flat, if you wanted to call it that. The JSE's performance, I think, was very, very gratifying. And also good to see a bit of a bounce back in some of the local economy stocks, and particularly in the financial shares, which, let's be honest, have been pretty dull for quite some time. But it was a good day, and interestingly, a day where some of the index heavyweights like Anglos and BHP Billiton were slightly down. So it tells you you know, let's call it SA Inc., was doing its part to make the JSC power ahead.
And one of those SA Inc. companies that came out with an update today is not one that we talk about particularly often, and that is Argent. They make fireplaces and, you know, steel stuff. They had a really nice trading update, and it's one of these companies that sort of flies below the radar usually because it's quite small by market standards, and it's actually quite nice.
Yeah, Bruce, and I think this is such a wonderful example, and it's a company we hold for quite a few of our clients and have held for a long time. And, you know, if you look at a price graph of this thing, if you paid, say, R5 a share in 2015, you looked like a complete fool for 5 or 6 years. But the, you know, as Warren Buffett always says, price is what you pay, or I suppose the share price you see in the paper or on your screen is what you see, but value is what you get. And, you know, for us, we saw a company that had a fairly solid NAV, very unloved, very unwatched by the bulk of the market. And, it's incredible. You know, if you look at the trading update today, they're telling us you're going to get around R2.25's worth of earnings for the year. You know, you go back to early 2020 and the share price was R5 a share. So, you know, it's going to give you 50% of the share price of 2 years ago. It's just been a phenomenal story. But I think for us, very gratifying to see companies that do the right thing. And here, of course, a strong argument for share buybacks. You know, when the asset value was R10 a share, they were buying back shares at R4, R5, R6, and so on, moving into tighter hands. So we're very pleased with the performance, and it just sort of reaffirms the view that it might take an awfully long time, but ultimately value does emerge. So,
but you've got to be patient. You've got to be patient. You're a more patient person than most. I'm looking at a share price graph now of Argent, and it did nothing for 3 years. And they sort of came to life at the beginning of 2019 and then moved sideways again. And only really in sort of the dying months of last year did it really start to go quite stratospheric. And it's had a spectacular run in the last couple of months. I think in the last 12 months, it's up about 160%. It's had a really good 12 months.
Yeah, so hopefully we've been forgiven by those clients that we've held it for the previous four years or whatever. But I think, to the point, Bruce, they were doing a lot of good things. They were shutting down the loss-making operations, offloading non-core assets, focusing on the profitable silos, buying back shares, which is both earnings and per share and NAV accretive. And in buying back, of course, it moves into tighter hands. And that's one of the things that people forget. You know, and we hold a number of these smaller cap companies that often are unloved. And the amazing thing is when, as you're seeing in that graph in front of you, when shares go from being, you know, having what I call sick share syndrome, where people say, well, there's something wrong because the share price is down, to suddenly everybody says, oh, hang on a second, we completely misread it. And that tight register actually swings in your favor. It is a beautiful thing to behold. My personal view is it's probably not going to be listed, you know, if I fast-track 2 years. Liquidity, the free float, etc., just doesn't warrant a listing. But we're awfully pleased to see it having run as hard as it had over the last year or 18 months.
Well, it's been very, very rewarding to watch. Less rewarding has been AB InBev, the world's biggest brewing company, which sold a story of value and growth if only it was allowed to buy the world's second biggest brewing company, which used to be called SAB Miller. It bought it. It got rid of any SAB identity. It then had to sell off a whole bunch of global assets and trim down so there weren't big overlaps in countries. It did all of that. It's worked really hard. And today that share price is nowhere near what the combined value of the companies was on the day that the deal was done. And I think it's been a massive disappointment for Carlos Brito, who announced he's leaving after 15 years in charge.
Yeah, and 32 years with the company, and arguably the new CEO, Michael, is coming in with a company that's kind of got the wind at its back. And, you know, what a difference a year makes. And it's a very noisy result, Bruce. So, you know, when you see the world's biggest brewer, who I think accounts for 1 in 3 beers sold in the world, you know, seeing volume growth of 13%, you think, wow, that's something spectacular. But we must remember, you know, that we've been in a COVID lockdown-induced world, and you know, not everything is immediately comparative. But I will say, you know, when AB InBev offered us, I think it was £42.50 for our SAB Miller shares, we said, thank you very much. Before you change your mind, we take it. We sold the shares in the market and ran because we felt, you know, we were biting off a lot. They were going to become internally focused. There'd be too much debt. And I think all of those things actually proved to be right. Mm. Having said all of that, and we've been quite worried about the valuations, et cetera, having said all of that, this result points to a business that I think is getting itself together. Mm. It's obviously still got some of the balance sheet issues, but it's looking a lot better. And Bruce, I mean, for me, the key was when you look at the premium brands, you know, the global brands, the Stella Artois of the world, you know, the comparable sales are up over 40%. Yes, there's some COVID-19 issues in there, but it also tells you that they're doing a lot of good things right. So, you know, with the Rand share price about half what it was, or less than half what it was when, you know, when they came sort of sniffing around SAB, it's looking to me a far more interesting proposition. But let's not kid ourselves. I think a lot of this is base effects, and there's still quite a lot of hard work to do. But it's looking a lot better and a great result in the first quarter of 2021.
Graham Koerner this evening, he's director at Koerner Perspective. Thanks for joining us this evening, Graham Koerner, bringing us up to speed with today's markets. A positive day, up about 0.33% by the close, 67,600. Really good day across financial stocks, nearly 2% stronger. Industrials added value. Resources were down on the day a bit. There were updates also from Mondi and Sappi, and the market frowned on those just a touch. Currency also improved markedly on the day.
Period.
Tala Gilimganga, Eyewitness News Sport.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's African Nacity. Absa is a registered FSP.
You're with Bruce Whitfield
on 702.
Let's walk the talk.
If you think you know everything there is to know about the elevator pitch, do you even know what an elevator pitch is? It's that one, you have a moment, you have 30 seconds. You're getting into an elevator and there is the person that you've always wanted to meet. There is the person you might be looking to do business with. There's the person that you might want to appear opposite in a movie. How do you pitch yourself in 30 seconds that is compelling and that will make the person want to see you again for a better meeting or bigger meeting or sign you up immediately? How do you do it? Rich Mulholland, who is the founder of Missing Link, posted a video on the skills you need. He's got a personal story too, which is worth sharing. We'll do that in about 10 minutes' time. But first, fascinating report on Eskom today, on Eskom on Bloomberg today. Eskom does not want to buy electricity from the company that has won most of a government emergency power tender. These are the power ships. The cost and the length of the contract, which lasts 20 years, are serious sticking points. The reason why Eskom doesn't want to buy this electricity, I would suggest, is because Eskom's not stupid. Independent energy analyst Clyde Mallinson. I mean, this is a really difficult contract for any chief executive to sign up to, regardless of who the boss is and who's calling the shots, Clyde.
Thanks, Bruce, and thanks to invite me onto your show, and welcome and hello to all of your listeners. Just very simply, I think the car power ships is something of a red herring, in my opinion. So the request for proposals to procure this power was done in a fashion that was not optimal, and it didn't allow for full use of the grid system. So it meant that the people bidding had a whole lot of restrictions, and because of those restrictions, the bids are all more expensive than they need be. And so the car power ships is one that came in, but all of the other bids are far more expensive than they need be. So it's not just the ships, it's the whole process really, which is poorly flawed and was poorly designed.
And just, I mean, so the process was badly designed, the process was flawed. So are the power ships the best solution for us then in the context of a flawed process? Or do we need to say, hold on a second, let's take a step back here and not commit ourselves to 20 years of penury with contracts like the ones that have been that look like they're going to be agreed to with the power ships, the Turkish power ships, and do it all over again?
Yeah. The power ships are competitive based on the rules that were made, which makes one ponder why the rules were made as they were. So I've got a couple of interesting analogies. People participating in this program weren't allowed to make use of the existing grid assets. So it was like saying, okay, I want you to drive from Joburg to Cape Town, and you say, great. And as you're about to leave, they say you're only allowed to go on dirt roads. You're not allowed to use the national network of tarred roads. And you say, hey, wait a minute, I'm going to get to Cape Town, but it's going to cost me 2.5 times as much as if I could use the network, the road network. And that's essentially what my main contention with the thing is. So in terms of the way the rules were set, the coal power ships compete with equivalent gas or other technologies onshore. But here's the thing. Eskom are being asked to buy 10 units at R1.58 per unit. They actually need 30 units. In other words, 10 units isn't enough blood to get our system up and running again. They're getting 10 pints and they need 30 pints. They could buy 30 pints at 60 cents a pint or 10 pints at R1.58 a pint. Which would you prefer?
No, exactly. I mean, and here's the problem is that you've got a government department negotiating on behalf of a power utility that knows its business better than the government department does. It knows what it needs. The government department, however, seems hell-bent on calling the shots, and that hasn't worked out particularly well for Eskom over a long period of time.
Yeah, no, it's just most unfortunate that that they haven't allowed proper system thinking on this. If you bought those 30 units instead of the 10,
yep,
at more or less a third of the price, a third of those 30 units, in other words 10, would meet all of the stringent requirements of the plan that they set forth. So in other words, you would get all of the things about capacity and being able to run and be dispatchable and deliverable and everything. So you get that as a byproduct. In much the same way when you mine platinum, you get copper and nickel as byproducts. So we all know that our system is desperate for an injection of new energy. The coal power ships won't inject as much as we need, and they'll be injecting it at 3 times the price that we could get it for.
Over a 20-year period, which is...
Over a 20-year period. I mean, the numbers are staggering. I mean, I've just been doing some sums for a client, and Eskom are essentially, with just the coal power ships, are committing to pay about $14 billion a year for 20 years, going up at whatever the cost of gas and the exchange rate are. You know, so it's you know, it's whatever it is, 14 something times 20 years. It's approaching R300 billion, the contract.
If I was to read between the lines here, Clyde, would you suggest it would be grotesquely irresponsible of South Africa to formalise this arrangement and to sign up?
It's irrational. It's irresponsible.
It's worse. It's irrational.
It's irrational. The, you know, in terms of putting it another way, if the coal power ship deals were brought and put in front of NERSA, who's meant to be a regulator, who regulates for fair and transparent and value for money and looking after the customer, if they put that in front of NERSA, all of the risk mitigation ones, and they put what the alternatives are that I've suggested to you, where we could buy 3 times as much at 40% per unit, NERSA, in my opinion, as an independent regulator, would have no alternative but to say we can't sign the ones on the left, we'll have to sign the ones on the right, because the ones on the left are irrational. You know, I mean, it's not difficult arithmetic. I mean, if I went to a vendor and they're selling Cokes, and I said, do you want to buy 10 Cokes from me to on-sell at R16 each, or would you rather buy 30 Cokes at R6 each? And then you have to sell them. You know, the guy's going to do the maths before even thinking.
Absolutely.
And he's going to employ 2 of his mates, so there's more jobs as well.
So we approached the Department Ministry of Energy today, and we said to them, could you chat to us about this? They said, no, it's all pure speculation. Bloomberg is reporting pure speculation. Bloomberg is quoting 2 independent sources within Eskom. It would not surprise you, I am sure, that there are people within Eskom who are seeing the futility of this particular course of action.
Well, you know, the prices in the electricity sector for renewables plus storage are heading towards $3 cents by 2030 for totally secure prime. Now, to put that in today's terms, that's about 45 cents a kilowatt hour. Easily by 2030. Eskom's price trajectory selling the old fossil coal is heading towards $15 cents by 2030. We know that. I mean, it's a published trajectory. So what's 15 times 15? That's 2 rand 25. So we're getting this divergence. And I mean, we've got ministers who are saying South Africa's got this incredibly cheap renewable energy. We can make green hydrogen and export it to Europe. So if we can make incredibly cheap green hydrogen to export to Europe on the one hand with cheap renewables, and at the same time we're charging our customer base four times as much for expensive non-renewables, I mean, what? How can that possibly be sanctioned? I mean, this goes right down to constitutional court, I would think. Properly and affordable electricity for everyone.
Clyde, thank you so much. Deeply thoughtful. Thank you. Clyde Mallinson this evening, the independent energy analyst.
702.
SMS Bruce.
On 31702.
We've done elevator pitches before on the show, and I've invited you to do yours, and we've laughed mostly at you, but with you, and enjoyed the process, and you've learned a huge amount from Pavlo's contribution on elevator pitches. It's great fun, but I've not laughed out loud and learned so much in such a short space of time as I did when I watched a video posted by one of South Africa's top business speakers, the owner of Missing Link, a company that builds presentations for people who can't do it themselves. His name is Rich Mulholland. What is the old saying, Rich Mulholland? You never get a second chance at making your first impression. I mean, that's the whole basis of the elevator pitch, right?
Right, exactly. You want to come out the gates as strong as you possibly can.
And you want to do it in a way that is forceful, that shows that you have a presence, that shows that, you know, whatever it is that you do or that you're trying to pitch to an individual, it shows your ability to do that. But you don't want to do it like a Randy Jack Russell who's got a hold of somebody's leg and is embarrassing itself without even knowing it.
I mean, that's definitely not the best approach, although I'm picturing you delivering a pitch that way right now, which is mildly amusing, but mostly disturbing.
Now, listen, Seth Godin, he's a global thinker. You're a bit of a fanboy of Seth Godin. Tell me a story, because you told us on a video that you posted recently, which tickled me, which is the basis of tonight's discussion. You got an invitation to go to the United States. I need the story beginning, middle, and end, please.
Right, so basically what happened is Seth released a book called The Purple Cow many years ago, like 2004. And the way the book was sold is you could buy it, but you could only buy 11 copies, not one. You could only buy it from Seth Godin's website. You couldn't get it from Amazon or Barnes & Noble. But the book you were getting, or the books, the 11 books you were getting when you bought this pack of 11, came in milk cartons. I was determined to get my 11 books. And I thought it was genius because the whole book was about being remarkable and spreading the word. And of course, nobody could read 11 copies of a book. So you would buy 11, keep one, and give 10 away, spreading the word. Thought it was genius. So the following morning, after the launch, I jumped on first thing in the morning. But by then, the 1,000 purchases had already happened and they were sold out. And I was devastated. So I mailed him. I said, Seth, is there any way that I could get a copy of this book in this form? I don't want the regular one. Now, something to know about Seth Godin is he basically answers all his mail. You might get a one-word answer, no, sorry, or yes, thank you. But he answered, and he said, well, actually, I'm running an event in my office in New York, Dobbs Ferry, in 2 weeks' time. If you come to New York, I'll give you one myself. And I was like, challenge accepted. So I jump on this plane. I get all excited. I fly from Joburg to Heathrow, and then I was on the plane from Heathrow to New York. Now, I had some air miles, and so I was flying Virgin Atlantic's upper class.
Ooh.
I felt like a rock star. Dude, I was sitting there. I had Linkin Park playing in my ears. I had my tattoo showing. My feet were up because you take off with your feet up. And I felt like royalty. Anyway, I'm sitting there listening to this music, and this flight attendant walks up to me. And she looks down at me and she says, hey, sorry, sir, sorry. Excuse me. And like I take out my earphone, she says, the team and I were just wondering. And she points over and these other two flight attendants standing there. And she says, the team and I were just wondering, are you in a band? Now, I am not going to promote lying to you right now on the radio.
No,
however,
I would be wrong.
I will say to you, if at any given time in your life somebody walks up to you with stars in their eyes and says, are you in a band? The only acceptable answer to that question is yes. Yes, I am. I'm totally in a band. Unfortunately, that's not what I said. What I accidentally said that day, which was the truth, I said, no, I'm a presentation strategist. I have never seen somebody so upset with an answer. It was like moving the final answer.
Oh, Rich, sorry. Yeah, you're moving your phone away from your mouth at the punchline, and it's we're losing you. You said to this beautiful person who was approaching you with stars in her eyes, no, I'm not a rock star. I am a presentation specialist. You're a rock star doing that, but she didn't necessarily appreciate the benefits of it. And your point, I think, is that you need a line. With whatever it is that you do, you need to have the most compelling line about what it is, whether you are a presentation specialist, a proctologist, or a professor of social science. Whatever it might be, you need to be able to convey that in a short and snappy and compelling way to keep the person who's approached you or who you're approaching's interest.
Right, because the elevator pitch is never about you. It's always about them.
Your job isn't to
tell them what you do, it's to make them care about what you do.
That is good. Okay, so how then, if I am CEO of Megacorp and you're trying now, as Rich Mulholland, the presentation specialist, not the band member, how do you approach me with your pitch then? Because you're a compelling character. You've got messy hair and tattoos and wear T-shirts and torn jeans. And I am in my three-piece suit. I wouldn't usually talk to you.
Right. Well, luckily, in my case, nobody needs presentations. They need a solution to boring presentations.
Ah.
So the last thing you feel like you need is somebody in a three-piece suit. But that's a story for another day. What happened, like that day on that plane, I realized I need a better way to describe what I do. And I came up with a format. And it's a two-step format. The first part is, you know how, when. And the second part is, well, what I do is. And that's all you have to do is to figure out the end of those two sentences. So if you're the CEO in your three-piece suit, and I was the president, you know how when you're standing in front of a group of people and you have something very compelling to tell them. In fact, you know it's even more important for them to hear it than it is for you to say it. It will make a material impact in their lives. Yet you're on that stage delivering a presentation, and all you see staring back at you is this ocean of dull, lifeless, bored faces. And I nod at them, and of course, they nod back at me. And at that point, I say the second line, which is, well, what I do is make sure that never happens to you again. I will work with you on your slides to make sure they're great. I will structure your story with you to make sure we cover only the most important bits. And then I will work with you as a speaker to make sure that when you get on that stage, you grab the audience by the throat and you drag them to the end.
Fabulous.
It's not about what you do. What you do is only important once they care. The job is not to sell the features and benefits of the ambulance. Your job is to sell the accident. Once you've sold the accident, the ambulance sells itself.
The two phrases that we need to remember. The what?
You know how, when, or you know how, and what I do is.
You know how.
So create the context.
What I do is. Fabulous. Rich Mulholland, thank you. Not a rock star. But a rock star doing what he does, I mean, he looks like a rock star. He's a guy who was a roadie for like Led Zeppelin and stuff when he was younger. So he could have got away with that fib. But yeah, you know when? What I do is pitch your elevator pitches like that, and I promise you, you will have more success. And search for Rich Mulholland's video. He reinforces those points. Listen to the podcast. Could be the most valuable 10 minutes you spend tonight or tomorrow.
The Money Show
with Bruce Whitfield on 702.
702.
The Money Show brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance. That's African Asity. Absa is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to The Money Show. I will be talking in a moment or six to Pavlo Fotidis from Auric Business Accelerator. We're talking about what is holding you back in your business at the moment. Why are you constraining your ability to grow. Lots of the businesses Pavlo works with are in growth mode and are finding it very rewarding to be in growth mode. And then Warren Ingram at 7:30, personal finance with Warren. I'm talking about what happens if your children are lucky enough to be inheriting something from you one day when you no longer need your money. Wasn't that sensitive? When you die, your kids may inherit something. And how prepared are they for that moment? And I suppose it all depends on scale and how much. But how can you better prepare them for that moment? We'll talk about that this evening on The Money Show. Well, I was scrolling through LinkedIn the other day and I came across the story of a young guy working at a builder's warehouse. Now, that in itself is no big deal. Lots of people work at builder's warehouse. But people were raving about his service. They also happened to mention that he was deaf. Now, my local Woolworths had a young guy working the tills for a while, and that was before COVID. And I was thinking the other day, I'd not seen him for a while. And I wonder if the fact that we're all wearing masks means that people who are hard of hearing or deaf are now excluded from doing many of the jobs that they could do very capably before COVID-19. COVID has had a really big impact on people who are hard of hearing. Marketing and Communications Director Manager at eDeaf is Nikki Besaidenert on the line to us from Durban. Nikki, are we seeing a huge impact on people who are hard of hearing, people who are deaf, who may have got a job 18 months ago in a service industry who simply can't because they can't lip read what you and I might want?
Yes. Thanks for having me. Yes, it has certainly been a challenge for the deaf community, deaf, deafened, and hard of hearing communities. But I think as hearing people, we tend to worry about deaf people more than they worry about themselves. So they have such a wonderful way of being able to make their needs known, and especially in a working environment as well. You know, we tend to worry more about them than they do about themselves. So, yeah, Sydney has been an amazing benefit to builders, and we've got lots of deaf people working all across South Africa who are coping, like the rest of us, obviously with the additional challenges of the face mask.
Talk to me about the process that you go through to help people, and lots of young people who are deaf, people like Sydney, who really could do brilliantly in the workplace but find it hard to break in.
Yeah. I think it's less about deaf people trying to break in and more about hearing people making opportunities available. So we've partnered with some wonderful companies like Builders and a number of others, especially in the wholesale and retail environment. Spa, for example, Mr. Price, Woolworths, etc. But yeah, eDeaf offer a number of services that are able to integrate a deaf person successfully into a company. So we primarily offer two services. So the E in eDeaf stands for employment and empowerment. And on the employment side, we work with recruitment. So it would be a deaf person going directly into a job. So we source deaf school leavers. We register them through one of our training centres. We take them through a job readiness training program to prepare them for the world of work. And then if they haven't achieved their matric, then we would place them on an NQF learnership, and that's where the empowerment side of things come in. And learnerships are really a wonderful way to upskill a previously disadvantaged group of people. And then we partner with companies who share our values, you know, that it's not just a triple BEE tick box exercise. And the point is obviously to upskill the learner and then recruit them. And eDeaf partner with those companies who genuinely want to add value by employing a deaf person into their business.
I mean, it's hard enough to get a job in South Africa, no matter how physically able you are, no matter how talented you are, no matter how good looking you are, no matter how qualified you are. But this is just another blimmin' obstacle for people to get work. And it's great that companies are helping and are making a massive contribution. But it's never going to be enough, I don't think, Nikki.
No, it won't be. And my role is really to meet with clients who are open to that possibility. I think when we have conversations with someone, our brain automatically interprets and recalls information in a way that confirms our existing beliefs or what we already hold to or believe to be true. So we spend a lot of time telling ourselves that we're right about something and less time considering that we might be wrong about something. So that's really my role, is to work with clients to maybe change some of their perceptions about the deaf community. You know, a lot of deaf people don't see themselves as disabled. They see themselves as a linguistic minority group. You know, I say to my clients, would you prefer to have a deaf manager or would you prefer to have a French manager? And if they're honest with themselves, they'll probably say, oh, a French manager, because somehow when you see somebody as disabled, you see them as incapable. South Africans love to shame a lot when actually we should be saying, oh, wow.
I mean, the burden that people can overcome is nothing short of extraordinary. And suddenly one finds oneself speaking louder and softer and, yes. and more enunciated, like you're stupid. And it's just so patronizing. It's so patronizing, exactly. And it is so awful. It's just, you know, one's got to get greater acceptance for people who are perfectly capable. They just can't hear. That's all that's wrong.
I think a lot of it is just ignorance. It's, you know, we don't know what we don't know. And so EDEF conduct deaf sensitization workshops, and that's really aimed at companies considering placing a deaf person into their environment. And it's an opportunity to look through the eyes of the deaf into the deaf person's world, and it's facilitated by deaf staff members and through our interpreters, obviously. And so we teach about that deaf people have such a rich history and culture, and it's an opportunity to catch a glimpse into their world, get an understanding of what makes them tick, what ticks them off, some do's and don'ts, hints and tips on what's an appropriate way to get a deaf person's attention, South African Sign Language etiquette, common workplace sounds we can teach that's specific to your environment. So it's fine if you know all the coffee sounds, for example, but you work in manufacturing, so how is that helpful?
Exactly. Nikki Macedo, thank you so much. Marketing and Communications Manager at EDEF, the Sydney video. I just came across it. I wish I could save half the stuff that I find on LinkedIn, but I haven't figured that out yet. I don't know if you can. But it's just this most wonderful insert about Sydney, who works at Builders Warehouse and is killing it, doing a great job. He's getting great satisfaction. His customers are getting great satisfaction. It's a win-win all round.
Small Business
with Pavlo Fatidis.
Pavlo Fatidis, it's said so beautifully, pronounced so wonderfully. Pavlo Fatidis, good evening to you. Nice to have you with us this evening. Have a good holiday.
I did, Bruce. It was a very interesting holiday. I managed to put about 4,500 kilometers behind me, looking at towns, looking at what's going on around the country, seeing signs of such incredible excitement around. There's so much happening that is so positive. And in the moment that you then blink, you open your eyes and suddenly realize that we still have a long, long way to go.
Yeah.
And the first thing, Bruce, the first thing I really need to just get it out, and I'm sorry, I have to get it out with you,
all right,
is it's rail-to-road story. The road from Johannesburg all the way down to the Eastern Cape has been invested heavily over the last, I'd say, 10 years. And the quality of those roads and the investment that has been poured into them is incredible. We truly have, and I travel extensively around the world, we truly have incredible road networks. And Bruce, the road from Craddock to Port Elizabeth left me in a situation where halfway in that journey, I lost count, overtaking over 82 26-wheeler 40-ton of tipper trucks carrying manganese from the north of Kimberley, destroying the town of Craddock. That is unserviceable because it has no road network left, taking truckload by truckload by truckload, parallel to a railway line, completely empty of any carriages. It is madness.
It's absolutely it's infuriating. I mean, and it's such a constraint on everybody and business, and it's such a catastrophic failure. It really is. Transnet does a great job on its pipelines. Transnet does a great job on the Sishen-Saldanha line, but Transnet needs to get its act together on the routes. I mean, these are the arteries of the country, and they could, you know, if you got trade flowing on those arteries, we would unclog the economy immediately. I'm going to stop with analogies. Now, listen, talk to me about what's holding back small businesses right now, because a lot of people, I mean, you go to these small towns and there's lots of energy and activity, and that's great because they have to make a plan. But a lot of people are, yeah, as always, despondent and are a bit afraid. I mean, rail to road is one thing. I suppose the other part of what's holding people back is supply chains. I mean, it's not just a local problem. It's a big global problem too.
No, it's everywhere. It's right around the world at the moment. And, you know, it's everything from computer chips to steel. The steel issue is a massive issue in South Africa at the moment. You know, we have a reasonably well-industrialized economy. And I'm saying industrialized from the point of view of services. So the mining industry is booming. Commodities are booming. Commodities, when you service a mine, when you service a mine site, you're using big trucks and big pieces of plant and equipment. You're using warehouses, things get broken and bashed and damaged. And in order to fix, maintain, repair, upkeep a mine site and keeping it safe, keeping it efficient, we have a very extensive net of industrial businesses involved in the servicing of that big piece of plant and equipment, that mine site. And Bruce, a lot of it requires steel, and there's hardly any steel available. The steel that is available has been really concentrated, and everything from people who make fences and install fences all the way through to fixing conveyor belts, all the way through to establishing new warehouses and shelving. There is a massive, massive steel shortage. And I had such an interesting debate with a very well-established fencing business recently, second generation. They were doing incredibly well, obviously pre-COVID. COVID arrived, and now they're in a situation where they simply cannot get wire. And wire is a fundamental element, obviously, of the fencing sector, the fencing industry. And I sat down with this business owner and I said, well, what are you doing about it? And he said, please, can you link me to sources of steel? And I attempted to, but sources of steel don't have steel either. And he said, what do I do to preserve my business? And I said, well, what are you doing to preserve your business? And he says, well, you know, my sales team is out there. He's got 16 people involved in sales and business development. They're traveling and visiting customers all around the country. We have on average about 80, 90 odd million rands worth of business that we cannot service because we don't have steel. And we're losing that business to competitors that might have some stock or manage to get some stock. And Bruce, it was so frustrating because the essence of any business is the customer. Forget the product. Forget what's happening internally in the business. When you're in a situation where your supply chain has been compromised, and this is facing many businesses, you need to do what you need to do to hold on to your customers. So immediately in this instance, he insisted that he needed the raw materials to manufacture the fencing. He insisted on needing to manufacture the fencing because if he were to import fencing, he would find himself in a situation where he would make no profit. But he has the argument. If you're going out there taking orders, creating false hope for customers who desperately need the fencing, not able to supply, you lose the customer in any event, so that when wire and steel gets back into the country, there's no fencing to be made because there's no demand for fencing because you've lost your customers. And in cases where your supply chain is broken as a manufacturer, you have to figure out to import the complete product. Rather make no profit over the next 6 months and hold on to those customers because the imports will be back.
It's so interesting. It's such a sad conversation with my local bike shop owner this week. I was out on my bicycle, which is a rare occurrence, and it was fabulous. As far as I can get from home, my pedals went dodgy and I needed help. And so I nursed the bicycle back through all the back ways and to my bike shop. And I was like, oh, good, I'm here. Noel will save me. And as I got there, I see the windows are papered over. And Noel is standing outside, sort of taking a long and meaningful look at his bike shop. And I'm like, Noel, what are you doing? He says, you know the economy. I have to shut down. He took one look at me, dragged me inside, and all of his shop fittings and everything was spread across the floor. He was getting ready to pack them up, and he told me the story of how one of the primary reasons, not only are fewer people cycling and fixing bicycles, and you don't have things like the Cape Epic and the 947, and you know, people are making a plan, but it's just, you know, people aren't fixing bicycles in the same way. And those that are getting frustrated because as a small player, he can't get hold of the parts he needs in order to do the fixes that he needs to do. And so his customers are going to bigger shops that do have the stronger supply chains. And it was just so sad. But he goes, look, you know what? And there's another bike shop coming here. It'll be here in 6 to 8 weeks. You'll be fine. Don't worry about it. They're taking over my staff. You know, they'll be fine. That's the most important thing. And he's going off to go and think about what he wants to do next. And he says, you know what? This business has been good to me. It's fine. And it's like, I felt traumatized for the guy, but his resilience and his ability to be philosophical about, well, that happens. And it's been great for 10 years. And he could carry on dragging it on for another year or 18 months. The economy might turn, things may improve. But what if they don't? He'll be heavily in debt. And so he chooses not to. And I think he's got a really productive mindset in that way. So his lease was coming to an end, so he called it. And it was good that he's done it because he'll find something else. And I think that's really important. He's not going to become a COVID zombie. He's not going to become a victim of the environment, which I think is good.
Yeah, and you know, COVID zombies have become a big thing. In the very first 6 months of lockdown, what happened when everyone had to go and work remotely, work from home, it created, Bruce, and not much has been written about this, surprisingly, because it literally is a consistent issue across 60% of businesses that I'm speaking with. It created what I refer to as a COVID zombie, where staff went home, employees went home, started to work from home, and all of a sudden found themselves to be incompetent. And the context within which their day-to-day work was delivered was in an office space or in a factory floor or in a warehouse, wherever the place of work would have been. You had colleagues around you. You might have leaned over from your desk, peering at your colleague's desk to remind yourself how to do something or get something done. And for a period of about 6 months or so last year, from April, it seemed as if people who had been very competent, very able, very capable of doing their jobs, doing their work, performing their duties, and thriving in doing so, put themselves or found themselves out of context and in an environment where they just weren't able to deliver work. What it did is it tested all the management theories and structures that existed across most businesses. And to the horror of many companies, they found that they actually were managing performance by activity. In other words, arrive at work at this time, leave at that time. I need to see you. I need to have an eye on the floor. I need to see who's busy, who's not, as opposed to output and activity in terms of an output, a measured outcome. What they then did during the course of last year, many companies had to adopt extensive digitization. They introduced it in how they communicate with their teams. They introduced it on how they collaborate. And slowly but surely, they started to introduce a whole lot of productivity softwares as well. And in that, it spurred a massive insecurity in amongst team members who never understood the bigger picture, who were nervous about the bigger picture, and generally most people have a resistance to technology, were apprehensive about what the technology meant, weren't sure if they were being spied on, weren't sure what the real reasoning was behind this, and went into a space and a place of malicious compliance with the new technologies. That immediately took leaders from the bridge of their ship where they should be leading the direction of their business, Bruce, right back down into the engine room where they're involved now, consumed in day-to-day activities with everything being delegated up. It's a big issue, and unless we as business owners resolve that, we will lose out on the growth opportunities already emerging from now to the end of the next financial year.
Pavlo Fatidis from Auric Business Accelerator. The big things holding small businesses back. Mostly, it's your own sort of thinking around the way in which your business is evolving. And you know, relying on the tech is one thing, but if you forget that it's people who are implementing the tech and using the tech, you're going to come short. You really are. Thanks, Pavlo.
The Money Show.
Personal finance with Warren Ingram.
Personal finance brought to you by Discovery Bank. The future of banking now. Warren Ingram. Tell us about what we need to know about giving money to children. I mean, having small children, I'm surprised that anybody's got any money left by the time they peg to give their children, because they seem to absorb money like Pampers absorb, you know, damp spots. Having children in the first place is quite an expensive process. And then the little blight is expected to inherit something one day. You know, I don't know who you're talking about here, but clearly there must be some people who want to at least one day leave something to their kids.
I think it's every parent's dream to be able to give their kids, a start in life as young adults if they can afford it. And so it is a conversation that comes up quite a lot. And you're right, it usually comes up when parents have conceived, but before the babies are born. And then the conversations go very quiet for quite a long time. And then, you know, somewhere towards the latter part of parents' lives, the conversation comes up again. And I think it's a important thing to consider. You know, we often focus as people on you know, our financial planning for ourselves. We focus on the immediate problems that face us, and we don't really think too far ahead, and especially, you know, around the education of our children about money. And so my first point here is, if you're going to leave money to your children, you really do have to plan far ahead. And it starts with actually starting to talk to them about money from a very young age. You know, it's a weird thing, you know, that parents often don't talk about money at all to their children. And so, you know, the worst thing I think that could happen is that we don't prepare our children financially just for their own lives. You know, even if we're not leaving them money, we need to have conversations with them and teach them about the way money works. You know, I often hear people saying, I wish I'd known about this. I wish the school had taught me this. And it's all good and well to you know, expect the school system to teach us these skills, but I feel there are life skills, and I feel there are conversations that should be had by parents, you know, with their children from very young, starting with pocket money and how you save, and then, you know, as they get older, starting to think about, you know, their role as potentially custodians of the family money. You know, I think that's, you know, it's an important thing. You don't want your kids to inherit money one day when they've had no concept of what to do with it and how to deal with it, and suddenly they inherit, you know, what in their lives might be an enormous amount of money that actually could ruin them. And it sounds funny to say that, but, you know, money does ruin lives if you inherit and you've been financially unprepared for it.
I mean, it's a nice problem to have, to be able to leave your kids a sizable amount of money, or any amount of money, quite frankly. And I wonder whether or not parents don't have the money conversations in the same way as they don't want to have the sex conversation. It's kind of awkward. And they sort of are maybe embarrassed by their own lack of knowledge when it comes to money. And they don't want to be challenged on money decisions perhaps they have made, because their kids will say, well, you're talking to me about investing. You talk to me about tax-free savings accounts. So have you put money into a tax-free savings account for me, Dad? It's like that advert from, I think, World War I, with a child sitting on the floor saying, so what did you do in the war, Dad? And Dad didn't fight, and he felt all sheepish about it. I wonder if it's parents sort of taking out their insecurities on their kids.
I think it's a really strong point. You know, I think you know, sometimes the parents are just embarrassed because their financial position is tough, and they don't want to make their kids afraid or burden their children unnecessarily. Or, as you say, it's just a very awkward conversation. But I think, you know, being awkward about something, unfortunately, is not good enough reason to avoid, you know, an important part of someone's education. And I think maybe that's the way to look at this, is that you're doing your children a major disservice if you don't prepare them for the world of money. And a tax-free savings is such a wonderful way to start a conversation like that, to say, well, you know, we need to start this for you, and you know, let's get going. And you know, what every month or every 6 months, talk about what's going on, how that tax-free is working, you know, when markets are rising, you know, what that means, and when markets are falling, what that means. And I think just starting to prepare children, you know, for money is it's just such a critical phase of, and part and parcel of their upbringing that I think parents, you know, maybe should adjust that attitude if it's one of awkwardness or embarrassment, and even if you're having financial difficulties, it doesn't mean that you need to burden your children, but talking them through, you know, the trade-offs that we need to make around money to say, well, we'd love to spend money on this, but unfortunately, you know, that means we would need to sacrifice something, and what are we collectively going to do around that? So I think it's a great education tool, by parents, and it's just not a conversation I think that teachers can have, for example, with their students. These are great conversations for parents and grandparents to have with children. Sorry, Bruce.
It's about managing expectations too. If you'd started a tax-free savings account for your child in April last year, they're going to think that every year their money will grow by 30 to 40%. And it's about managing those expectations, because when it doesn't, and they then get despondent about the way in which markets are performing, or suddenly there is a crash, or you'd started the tax-free savings account in January last year, and in April their money had almost halved in value, that could have been quite damaging as well. And so it's about sort of, I think, a lot of active coaching before you start committing the money and saying, this is, you know, what a stock market is. This is what a company is. This is what a share is. And you buy shares in companies. And if they do well, it goes up. But if, you know, somebody sneezes on somebody getting onto a plane in China and it goes around the world, well, then you can lose a lot of money. And trying to explain it in those sorts of terms is absolutely pivotal, because kids, you know, depending on their age and their ability to look at graphs, don't give a damn about the fact that, you know, there's a JSE graph that starts 50 years ago in the bottom left-hand corner, is now in the top right-hand corner, and it's done very well over 50 years, thanks very much. They want the here and now. They want to see a statement with their name on it and a number in the bottom right-hand corner that's going up all the time.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, you can make these investments more real for children as well, you know, where, you know, rather than just, for example, talking about the JSE index or the world index, you know, you could say, well, you know, you play computer games, and, you know, your computer game manufacturer happens to be part of this index, and, you know, you buy your clothes here and that happens to be part of this index. Or, you know, if you want, you can actually buy those shares for your kids in an account of theirs that you help them select. Obviously, you've got to put the training wheels on. Don't let them just go and choose the things they want. They might do better than the average stockbroker or fund manager. But
or
they
not.
Might do a lot
or
worse.
Not. I mean, the thing is, I don't know what's worse, them losing a whole lot of money from being careless and not paying attention, or just through ignorance, or actually succeeding in the first month and thinking they're geniuses, because that could be worse, actually.
I think overconfidence with money is a flaw that hits many of us, especially when we're young and we've just started to get our financial education, and we think we know everything very quickly, and that's where Mr. Market comes in and teaches us some great lessons.
Yeah.
And I think maybe just to talk to adults, you know, adult children as well. You know, this is another thing I find happens a lot. You talk to the parents who, you know, maybe are in their mid to late 60s, and they say, you know, we've got a family home or a holiday house that should never be sold. You know, all our children will want to visit this with their children for, you know, years and decades ahead. And then those parents pass away, having faithfully looked after that holiday house for decades. And the adult children promptly sell it because they didn't ever want to go back there. They were just doing it to humor their parents. And conversations like that, I think, are also critical when you're talking about inheritances. Don't make assumptions as the parents about what your children would want. You know, it's a tough and a hard conversation to have, but it's worth chatting to them and saying to them, you know, very practically, if we have a family property, you know, who's going to look after it? And someone needs to start looking after that now, because, you know, you need to know what's going on. We can't be around forever. That's a whole different conversation. But it's amazing how a few key conversations can prevent an enormous amount of pain and anguish later in life. And just conversations that just don't seem to be had.
A lot of families are uncomfortable with their children knowing their financial position at any stage in their life. At what point do children need to be going to the meeting with a financial advisor?
I think somewhere through the end of high school and the beginning of their working lives or through their university lives, I think is ideal. And just starting, because that financial education for the children, takes on a different level. Then they start to understand what a relationship between an adult and a financial advisor looks like, and maybe a good or a bad one, and some of the more difficult conversations. And I've seen it happen sometimes where the parents use the financial advisor as a referee, around decisions and we can't do this because the advisor says we can't afford it. Those kinds of conversations.
And the advisor's hiding under the table. Yeah.
Yeah. Going, I never said that, but those are the conversations to have. And I think especially, when your children start to think about their own children, they need to be fully prepared by then.
Warren Ingram from Galileo Capital, he is educating us about how we need to educate kids about money. Got a great question for you this evening, Warren. And George has got a wonderful problem. It's a terrifying problem. George's daughter has been accepted to study abroad. He doesn't have any capital offshore and he needs to get some money out of South Africa to help her fund her expenses. What must he do? We'll pick up on that question in a moment.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa Commercial Property Finance, committed to delivering innovative solutions for groundbreaking developments. That's Africanacity. Absa's a registered FSP.
The Money Show.
Personal Finance with Warren Ingram.
So, Warren, how does George deal with his wonderful problem? He must be incredibly proud of his daughter. She's got a place to study internationally, but George doesn't have any money outside the country. What does he need to do to help support her for, 2 years, 3 years? I don't know what. And we don't know the amounts, and we don't know where, and we don't know what, but some broad brushstrokes.
So I just did a little googling research to see what this sort of costs, both university fees and then the cost of living, over and above the university fees, and you're probably looking at an expense of around about 1 to 1.5 million rand a year at the moment at the current exchange rates, and so I think the thing to understand about this is, if your daughter's been accepted now, that means, you've got, you're probably starting, or she's probably starting in August, and so your expenses are unknown. It's not as if, you can say to the university, look, the rand's just, just taken a bit of a pounding. Would you hang on a few months? I'm just going to wait for the rand to strengthen before I start to send you the money. They're just going to laugh at you. So you need to know that your costs are fixed. Let's just use the US as an example to make things simple. If the rand is trading at sort of 14.50 rand to the dollar, I would consider that in the current economic climate, that's a decent exchange rate. Then I would be trying to convert as much of the future expenses to dollars as quickly as possible, because you don't want to be in a position where we get, for example, some major reoccurrence of COVID and it causes the world to get, deeply fearful again, and we're sitting at 20 to the dollar next year, and that's the point when you need to send your money out. So when the rand is strong, and as it is now, then I think you try and get your money converted to that foreign exchange rate as fast as possible. And then, unfortunately, you can't be that fancy with it when it's on the other side, because you know if your expense is going to be once a year for the next 3 years, then you can't invest it in shares or even a balanced unit trust overseas. You unfortunately need to just lock it in to the best interest rate you can, which is going to be pretty close
almost
to zero. Unfortunately,
yeah.
But you've protected yourself from the event of a rand collapse where you're suddenly paying 30% more just because you need to convert that much more rands to get the same amount of dollars.
Yeah, it's a real concern for a lot of families, I think. I mean, bright kids, and they want to expand and they want to do stuff that's not available locally, or they may not get into the courses they want to get in locally. And so parents, then stump up. And it's a big, big ask, and it's very, very significant. Your phrase of the week, this is an interesting one, donations tax. Who pays donations tax?
So The person who makes the donation. So in other words, let's say I'd like to leave some money, to my favorite barista at at my office, and I decide
I thought about you, my favorite radio presenter. No, but that's okay. Barista, fine. Okay.
So I decide Fulu at my office, my barista. You know, he would do really well with some money for his future expenses, or to set him up for a deposit on his house, or whatever the deal is. So I could do that. There's nothing in the law that stops me giving money to anybody. But what I need to know is that if I give anybody money who's not my immediate family that I'm looking after, in other words, I'm not paying their normal cost of living, the moment I give them more than 100,000 rand in a year, I'm going to pay tax on that. And it works out that, you know, let's say I gave away 500,000 rand. I would be paying tax of 20% on the amount over 100,000 rand. So that 400,000, to make up the 500,000, effectively we'd be paying away nearly 100,000 rand of that in tax. So the person who receives the money won't be paying it, but the person who's giving it away, they will pay donations tax. And that tax of 20%, will be what most people would pay if they were going to give away money. But if you're extremely wealthy and you give away more than 30 million rand, then you're going to be giving away 25% of that donation value as tax to SARS. So my comment here is, if we think through the topics we've spoken about, if you're going to give away money, for example, to adult children, et cetera, then make sure that, when you're no longer looking after them financially, maybe start giving them money in your lifetime. Start giving away, your up to 100,000 rand per year to people that you care about, rather than giving it all away in one batch, or possibly once you've passed away. There is a way to do that and to reduce the amount of tax that you pay legally, completely legally, by giving away up to 100,000 rand a year.
All right, what happens if you win the lottery and you've got a vast amount of money, and you think to yourself, well, one day I'm going to pay inheritance tax on pay estate duty on this money. I've got kids who are 12 and 13. Give them, give them 10 million rand each now. And because they're dependent on me, there's no tax on that, or is there?
I think that would be a tricky one, because the law says it must be for their maintenance.
And they're very expensive, Your Honour. Okay, but I get the picture. Yeah. So the kind of 100,000 rand ballpark rule is kind of across the ages, right?
Exactly right, and certainly, it's just important to know, if there are two parents in the picture, then each parent can give away 100,000 a year as well. So you end up being able to do 200,000 a year, and certainly, I don't think SARS would give anyone a hard time for doing that. Maybe if your maintenance cost was partly their tax-free savings or something, you might be able to wangle it. I don't think so. I think SARS are quite sharp on these things.
Thank you, Warren Ingram. Warren Ingram is an executive director and personal financial advisor at Galileo Capital.